The Phonograph, abridged from Edison, His Life and Inventions by Frank Lewis Dyer and Thomas Comerford Martin. The analysis of sound, which owes so much to Helmholtz, was one step toward recording, and the various means of illustrating the phenomena of sound to the eye and ear prior to the phonograph were all ingenious. One can watch the dancing little flames of Koenig and see a voice expressed in tongues of fire, but the record can only be photographic. In like manner, the simple phonautograph of Leon Scott, invented about 1858, records on a revolving cylinder of blackened paper the sound vibrations transmitted through a membrane to which a tiny stylus is attached, so that a human mouth uses a pen and inscribes its sign vocal. Ingenuity has been shown also in the invention of talking machines like Faber's based on a reed organ pipe. These automatic can be made by dexterous manipulation to jabber a little like a doll with its monotonous mama or a cuckoo clock, but they lack even the sterile utility of the imitation art of ventriloquism. The real great invention lies in creating devices that shall be able to evoke from tinfoil, wax, or composition at any time of day or in the future the sound that once was as effervescent as the vibrations it made on the air. Sometime prior to 1877, Edison had been experimenting on an automatic telegraph in which the letters were formed by embossing strips of paper with the proper arrangement of dots and dashes. By drawing this strip beneath a contact lever, the latter was actuated so as to control the circuits and send the desired signals over the line. It was observed that when the strip was moved very rapidly, the vibration of the lever resulted in the production of an audible note. With these facts before him, Edison reasoned that if the paper strip could be imprinted with elevations and depressions representative of sound waves, they might be caused to actuate a diaphragm so as to reproduce the corresponding sounds. The next step in the line of development was to form the necessary undulations on a strip, and it was then reasoned that original sounds themselves might be utilized to form a graphic record by actuating a diaphragm and causing a cutting or indenting point carried thereby to vibrate in contact with a moving surface, so as to cut or indent the record therein. Strange as it may seem, therefore, and contrary to the general belief, the phonograph was developed backward, the production of the sounds being of prior development to the idea of actually recording them. Mr. Edison's own account of the invention of the phonograph is intensely interesting. "I was experimenting," he says, "on an automatic method of recording telegraph messages on a disc of paper laid on a revolving platen, exactly the same as the disc talking machine of today. The platen had a spiral groove on its surface, like the disc. Over this was placed a circular disc of paper. An electromagnet with the embossing point connected to the arm traveled over the disc, and any signals given through the magnets were embossed on the disc of paper. If this disc was removed from the machine and put on a similar machine provided with a contact point, the embossed record would create the signals to be repeated into another wire. The ordinary speed of telegraphic signals is 35 to 40 words a minute, but with this machine several hundred words were possible. From my experiments on the telephone, I knew of the power of a diaphragm to take up sound vibrations, as I had made a little toy which, when you recited loudly in the funnel, would work a pawl connected to the diaphragm, and this engaging a ratchet wheel served to give continuous rotation to a pulley. This pulley was connected by a cord to a little paper toy representing a man sawing wood. Hence, if one shouted, 'Mary had a little lamb,' etc., the paper man would start sawing wood. I reached the conclusion that if I could record the movements of the diaphragm properly, I could cause such record to reproduce the original movements imparted to the diaphragm by the voice, and thus succeed in recording and reproducing the human voice." Instead of using a disc, I designed a little machine using a cylinder provided with grooves around the surface. Over this was to be placed tin foil, which easily received and recorded the movements of the diaphragm. A sketch was made, and the piecework price, $18, was marked on the sketch. I was in the habit of marking the price I would pay on each sketch. If the workman lost, I would pay his regular wages. If he made more than the wages, he kept it. The workman who got the sketch was John Crucy. I didn't have much faith that it would work, expecting that I might possibly hear a word or so that would give hope of a future for the idea. Crucy, when he had nearly finished it, asked what it was for. I told him I was going to record talking, and then have the machine talk back. He thought it absurd. However, it was finished. The foil was put on. I then shouted, "Mary had a little lamb," etc. I adjusted the reproducer, and the machine reproduced it perfectly. I was never so taken aback in my life. Everybody was astonished. I was always afraid of things that worked the first time. Long experience proved that there were great drawbacks found generally before they could be got commercial, but here was something there was no doubt of. No wonder that honest John Crucy, as he stood listening to the marvelous performance of the simple little machine he himself had just finished, ejaculated in an awe-stricken tone, "Mein Gott in Himmel!" And yet he had already seen Edison do a few clever things. No wonder they sat up all night fixing and adjusting it so as to get better and better results, reciting and singing, trying each other's voices, and then listening with involuntary awe as the words came back again and again, just as long as they were willing to revolve the little cylinder with its dotted spiral indentations in the tin foil under the vibrating stylus of the reproducing diaphragm. It took time to acquire the knack of turning the crank steadily before leaning over the recorder to talk into the machine, and there was some deftness required also in fastening down the tinfoil on the cylinder where it was held by a pin running in a longitudinal slot. Paraffin paper appears also to have been experimented with as an impressible material. It is said that Carmen, the foreman of the machinery shop, had gone the length of wagering Edison a box of cigars that the device would not work. All the world knows that he lost. The original Edison phonograph, thus built by Crucy, is preserved in the South Kensington Museum, London. That repository can certainly have no greater treasure of its kind. But as to its immediate use, the inventor says, "That morning I took it over to New York and walked into the office of Scientific American, went up to Mr. Beach's desk and said I had something to show him. He asked what it was. I told him I had a machine that would record and reproduce the human voice. I opened the package, set up the machine, and recited 'Mary Had a Little Lamb,' etc. Then I reproduced it so that it could be heard all over the room. They kept me at it until the crowd got so great Mr. Beach was afraid the floor would collapse and we were compelled to stop. The papers next morning contained columns. None of the writers seemed to understand how it was done. I tried to explain it was so very simple, but the results were so surprising they made up their minds probably they would never understand it, and they didn't. I started immediately making several larger and better machines, which I exhibited at Menlo Park to crowds. The Pennsylvania Railroad ran special trains. Washington people telegraphed me to come on. I took a phonograph to Washington and exhibited it in the room of James C. Blaine's niece, Gail Hamilton, and members of Congress and notable people of that city came all day long until late in the evening. I made one break. I recited 'Mary,' etc., and another ditty. There was a little girl who had a little curl right in the middle of her forehead, and when she was good, she was very, very good, but when she was bad, she was horrid." It will be remembered that Senator Roscoe Conkling, then very prominent, had a curl of hair on his forehead, and all the caricaturists developed it abnormally. He was very sensitive about the subject. When he came in, he was introduced, but being rather deaf, I didn't catch his name, but sat down and started the curl ditty. Everybody tittered, and I was told that Mr. Conkling was displeased. About 11 o'clock at night, word was received from President Hayes that he would be very much pleased if I would come up to the White House. I was taken there and found Mr. Hayes and several others waiting. Among them was Carl Schurz, who was playing the piano when I entered the room. The exhibition continued till about 12:30 a.m. when Mrs. Hayes and several other ladies who had been induced to get up and dressed appeared. I left at 3:30 a.m. For a long time, some people thought there was trickery. One morning at Menlo Park, a gentleman came to the laboratory and asked to see the phonograph. It was Bishop Vincent who helped Lewis Miller found the Chautauqua. I exhibited it, and then he asked if he could speak a few words. I put on a fresh foil and told him to go ahead. He commenced to recite biblical names with immense rapidity. On reproducing it, he said, "I am satisfied now. There isn't a man in the United States who could recite those names with the same rapidity." The phonograph was now fairly launched as a world sensation, and a reference to the newspapers of 1878 will show the extent to which it and Edison were themes of universal discussion. Some of the press notices of the period were most amazing and amusing. As though the real achievement of this young man, barely 30, were not tangible and solid enough to justify admiration of his genius, the yellow journalists of the period began busily to create an Edison myth with gross absurdities of assertion and attribution from which the modest subject of it all has not yet ceased to suffer with unthinking people. A brilliantly vicious example of this method of treatment is to be found in the Paris Figaro of that year, which, under the appropriate title of This Astonishing Edison, lay bare before the French public the most startling revelations as to the inventor's life and character. "It should be understood," said the journal, "that Mr. Edison does not belong to himself. He is the property of the Telegraph Company, which lodges him in New York at a superb hotel, keeps him on a luxurious footing, and pays him a formidable salary, so as to be the one to know of and profit by his discoveries. The company has, in the dwelling of Edison, men in its employ who do not quit him for a moment at the table, on the street, in the laboratory, so that this wretched man, watched more closely than ever was any malefactor, cannot even give a moment's thought to his own private affairs without one of his guards asking him what he is thinking about." This foolish black was accompanied by a description of Edison's new aerophone, a steam machine which carried the voice a distance of 1.5 miles. "You speak to a jet of vapor, a friend previously advised can answer you by the same method." Nor were the American journals backward in this wild exaggeration. The furor had its effect in stimulating a desire everywhere on the part of everybody to see and hear the phonograph. A small commercial organization was formed to build and exploit the apparatus, and the shops at Menlo Park Laboratory were assisted by the little Bergman shop in New York. Offices were taken for the new enterprise at 203 Broadway, where the Mail and Express building now stands, and where, in a general way, under the auspices of a talented dwarf, C.A. Cheever, the embryonic phonograph and the crude telephone shared rooms and expenses. Gardner G. Hubbard, father-in-law of Alexander Graham Bell, was one of the stockholders in the phonograph company, which paid Edison $10,000 cash and a 20% royalty. This curious partnership was maintained for some time, even when the Bell telephone offices were removed to Reed Street, New York, whither the phonograph went also, and was perhaps explained by the fact that just then the ability of the phonograph as a moneymaker was much more easily demonstrated than that of the telephone, still in its short-range magneto stage, and awaiting development with the aid of the carbon transmitter. The earning capacity of the phonograph then, as largely now, lay in its exhibition qualities. The royalties from Boston, ever intellectually awake and ready for something new, ran as high as $1,800 a week. In New York, there was a ceaseless demand for it, and with the aid of Hilborn L. Roosevelt, a famous organ builder and uncle of ex-President Roosevelt, concerts were given at which the phonograph was featured. To manage this novel show business, the services of James Redpath were called into requisition with great success. Redpath, famous as a friend and biographer of John Brown, as a Civil War correspondent, and as founder of the celebrated Redpath Lyceum Bureau in Boston, divided the country into territories, each section being leased for exhibition purposes on a basis of percentage of the gate money. To 203 Broadway, from all over the Union, flocked a swarm of showmen, cranks, and particularly of old operators, who, the seedier they were in appearance, the more insistent they were that Tom should give them, for sake of auld lang syne, this chance to make a fortune for him and for themselves. At the top of the building was a floor on which these novices were graduated in the use and care of the machine, and then, with an equipment of tinfoil and other supplies, they were sent out on the road. It was a diverting experience while it lasted. The excitement over the phonograph was maintained for many months, until a large proportion of the inhabitants of the country had seen it, and then the show receipts declined and dwindled away. The original phonograph, as invented by Edison, remained in its crude and immature state for almost 10 years. It continued to be a theme of curious interest to the imaginative and the subject of much fiction, while its neglected commercial possibilities were still more or less vaguely referred to. During this period of arrested development, Edison was continuously working on the invention and commercial exploitation of the incandescent lamp. In 1887, his time was comparatively free, and the phonograph was then taken up with renewed energy, and the effort made to overcome its mechanical defects and to furnish a commercial instrument so that its early promise might be realized. The important changes made from that time up to 1890 converted the phonograph from a scientific toy into a successful industrial apparatus. The idea of forming the record on tin foil had been early abandoned, and in its stead was substituted a cylinder of wax-like material, in which the record was cut by a minute chisel-like gouging tool. Such a record, or phonogram as it was called, could be removed from the machine or replaced at any time. Many reproductions could be obtained without wearing out the record, and whenever desired, the record could be shaved off by a turning tool so as to present a fresh surface on which a new record could be formed, something like an ancient palimpsest. A wax cylinder having walls less than 1/4 inch in thickness could be used for receiving a large number of records. Since the maximum depth of the record groove is hardly ever greater than 1/1 inch, later on, and as the crowning achievement in the phonograph field from a commercial point of view, came the duplication of records to the extent of many thousands from a single master. This work was actively developed between the years 1890 and 1898, and its difficulties may be appreciated when the problem is stated. The copying from a single master of many millions of excessively minute sound waves, having a maximum width of 1/100 inch and a maximum depth of 1/1 inch, or less than the thickness of a sheet of tissue paper. Among the interesting developments of this process was the coating of the original or master record with a homogeneous film of gold. Another important change was in the nature of a reversal of the original arrangement. The cylinder, or mandrel, carrying the record, being mounted in fixed bearings, and the recording or reproducing device being fed lengthwise, like the cutting tool of a lathe, as the blank or record was rotated. It was early recognized that a single needle for forming the record and the reproduction therefrom was an undesirable arrangement, since the formation of the record requires a very sharp cutting tool, while satisfactory and repeated reproduction suggests the use of a stylus which would result in the minimum wear. After many experiments and the production of a number of types of machines, the present recorders and reproducers were evolved. The former, consisting of a very small cylindrical gouging tool having a diameter of about 40 thousandths of an inch, and the latter a ball or button-shaped stylus with a diameter of about 35 thousandths of an inch. By using an incisor of this sort, the record is formed by a series of connected grooves with rounded sides, varying in depth and width, and with which the reproducer automatically engages and maintains its engagement. Another difficulty encountered in the commercial development of the phonograph was the adjustment of the recording stylus so as to enter the wax-like surface to a very slight depth, and of the reproducer so as to engage exactly the record when formed. The earlier types of machine were provided with separate screws for effecting these adjustments, but considerable skill was required to obtain good results, and great difficulty was experienced in meeting the variations in the wax-like cylinders due to the warping under atmospheric changes. Consequently, with the early types of commercial phonographs, it was first necessary to shave off the blank accurately before a record was formed thereon in order that an absolutely true surface might be presented. Another improvement that followed along the lines adopted by Edison for the commercial development of the phonograph was making the recording and reproducing styluses of sapphire, an extremely hard, non-oxidizable jewel, so that those tiny instruments would always retain their true form and effectively resist wear. Its essential use, as then contemplated, was as a substitute for stenographers, and the most extravagant fancies were indulged in as to the utility in that field. To exploit the device commercially, the patents were sold to Philadelphia capitalists who organized the North American Phonograph Company, through which leases for limited periods were granted to local companies doing business in special territories, generally within the confines of a single state. Under that plan, resembling the methods of 1878, the machines and blank cylinders were manufactured by the Edison Phonograph Works. The marketing enterprise was early doomed to failure, principally because the instruments were not well understood. At first, the instruments were leased, but it was found that the leases were seldom renewed. Efforts were then made to sell them, but the prices were high, from $100 to $150. In the midst of these difficulties, the chief promoter of the enterprise, Mr. Lippincott, died. The North American Phonograph Company failed, its principal creditor being Mr. Edison, who, having acquired the assets of the defunct concern, organized the National Phonograph Company, to which he turned over the patents, and with characteristic energy he attempted again to build up a business with which his favorite and to him most interesting invention might be successfully identified. The National Phonograph Company from the start determined to retire at least temporarily from the field of stenographic use and to exploit the phonograph for musical purposes as a competitor of the music box. Hence it was necessary that for such work, the relatively heavy and expensive electric motor should be discarded, and a simple spring motor constructed with a sufficiently sensitive governor to permit accurate musical reproduction. Such a motor was designed and is now used on all phonographs, except on such special instruments as may be made with electric motors. The invention of the phonograph was immediately followed, as usual, by the appearance of several other incidental and auxiliary devices, some patented, and others remaining simply the application of the principles of apparatus that had been worked out. One of these was the telephonograph, a combination of a telephone at a distant station with a phonograph. The diaphragm of the phonograph mouthpiece is actuated by an electromagnet in the same way as that of an ordinary telephone receiver, and in this manner a record of the message spoken from a distance can be obtained and turned into sound at will. Evidently, such a process is reversible, and the phonograph can send a message to the distant receiver. The idea was brilliantly demonstrated in practice in February 1889 by Mr. W. J. Hammer one of Edison's earliest and most capable associates, who carried on telephonographic communication between New York and an audience in Philadelphia. The record made in New York on the Edison phonograph was repeated into an Edison carbon transmitter, sent over 103 miles of circuit, including 6 miles of underground cable, received by an Edison motograph, repeated by that onto a phonograph, transferred from the phonograph to an Edison carbon transmitter, and by that delivered to the Edison motograph receiver in the enthusiastic lecture hall, where everyone could hear every sound and syllable distinctly. A further step in this line brought Edison to the aerophone, around which the Figaro weaved its fanciful description. In the construction of the aerophone, the same kind of tympanum is used as in the phonograph, but the imitation of the human voice or the transmission of sound is effected by the quick opening and closing of valves placed within a steam whistle or an organ pipe. The vibrations of the diaphragm communicated to the valves cause them to open in synchronism so that the vibrations are thrown upon the escaping air or steam, and the result is an instrument with a capacity of magnifying sounds 200 times and of hurling them at great distances intelligibly, like a huge fog siren, but with immense clearness and penetration. Somewhat weary of all this work and excitement, not having enjoyed any sensation from toil or period of rest for 10 years, Edison jumped eagerly at the opportunity afforded him in the summer of 1878 of making a westward trip. The lure was the opportunity to try the ability of his delicate tessimeter during the total eclipse of the sun, July 29th. His admiring friend, Professor George F. Baker of the University of Pennsylvania, with whom he had now been on terms of intimacy for some years, suggested the holiday and was himself a member of the excursion party that made its rendezvous at Rawlins, Wyoming Territory. Edison had tested his tessimeter and was satisfied that it would measure down to the millionth part of a degree Fahrenheit. It was just 10 years since he had left the West in poverty and obscurity, a penniless operator in search of a job. But now he was a great inventor and famous, a welcome addition to the band of astronomers and physicists assembled to observe the eclipse and the corona. "There were astronomers from nearly every nation," says Mr. Edison. "We had a special car. The country at that time was rather new. Game was in great abundance and could be seen all day long from the car window, especially antelope. We arrived at Rawlins about 4 p.m. It had a small machine shop and was the point where locomotives were changed for the next section. The hotel was a very small one, and by doubling up we were barely accommodated. My roommate was Fox, the correspondent of the New York Herald. After we retired and were asleep, a thundering knock on the door awakened us. Upon opening the door, a tall, handsome man with flowing hair, dressed in a Western style, entered the room. His eyes were bloodshot, and he was somewhat inebriated. He introduced himself as Texas Jack and said he wanted to see Edison, as he'd read about me in the newspapers. Both Fox and I were rather scared, and we didn't know what was to be the result of the interview. The landlord requested him not to make so much noise, and was thrown out into the hall. Jack explained that he'd just come in with a party which had been hunting, and that he felt fine. He explained also that he was the boss pistol shot of the West, that it was he who taught the celebrated Dr. Carver how to shoot. Then suddenly pointing to a weather vane on the freight depot, he pulled out a Colt revolver and fired through the window, hitting the vane. The shot awakened all the people, and they rushed in to see who was killed. It was only after I told him I was tired and would see him in the morning that he left. Both Fox and I were so nervous we didn't sleep any that night. The first thing the astronomers did was to determine with precision their exact locality upon the Earth. A number of observations were made, and Watson of Michigan University and two others worked all night computing until they agreed. They said they were not in error by more than 200 feet and that the station was 12 miles out of the position given on the maps. It seemed to take an immense amount of mathematics. I preserved one of the sheets which looked like the timetable of a Chinese railroad. The instruments of the various parties were then set up in different parts of the little town and got ready for the eclipse which was to occur in 3 or 4 days. 2 days before the event, we all got together and obtained an engine and car, went 12 miles further west to visit the United States government astronomers at a place called Separation, the apex of the Great Divide, where the waters run east of the Mississippi and west of the Pacific. Fox and I took our Winchester rifles with an idea of doing a little shooting. After calling on the government people, we started to interview the telegraph operator at this most lonely and desolate spot. After talking over old acquaintances, I asked him if there was any game around. He said, "Plenty of jackrabbits." These jackrabbits are a very peculiar species. They have ears about 6 inches long and very slender legs, about 3 times as long as those of an ordinary rabbit, and travel at great speed by a series of jumps, each about 30 feet long, as near as I could judge. The local people called them narrow-gauge mules. Asking the operator the best direction, he pointed west, and noticing a rabbit in clear space in the sage brushes, I said, "There's one now." I advanced cautiously to within 100 feet and shot. The rabbit paid no attention. Then I advanced to within 10 feet and shot again. The rabbit was still immovable. On looking around, the whole crowd at the station were watching, and then I knew the rabbit was stuffed. The eclipse was, however, the prime consideration, and Edison followed the example of his colleagues in making ready. The place which he secured for setting up his tessimeter was an enclosure hardly suitable for the purpose, and he describes the results as follows. "I had my apparatus in a small yard enclosed by a board fence 6 feet high. At one end there was a house for hens. I noticed that they all went to roost just before totality. At the same time, a slight wind rose, and at the moment of totality, the atmosphere was filled with thistle down and other light articles. I noticed one feather, whose weight was at least 150 milligrams, rise perpendicularly to the top of the fence where it floated away on the wind. My apparatus was entirely too sensitive, and I got no results. It was found that the heat from the corona of the sun was 10 times the index capacity of the instrument, but this result did not leave the value of the device in doubt. The eclipse over, Edison, with Professor Barker, Major Thornburg, several soldiers, and a number of railroad officials went hunting about 100 miles south of the railroad in the Ute country. A few months later, the major and 30 soldiers were ambushed near the spot at which the hunting party had camped, and all were killed. Through an introduction from Mr. Jay Gould, who then controlled the Union Pacific, Edison was allowed to ride on the cow catchers of the locomotives. The different engineers gave me a small cushion, and every day I rode in this manner from Omaha to the Sacramento Valley, except through the snowshed on the summit of the Sierras, without dust or anything else to obstruct the view. This welcome vacation lasted nearly 2 months, but Edison was back in his laboratory and hard at work before the end of August, gathering up many loose ends and trying out many thoughts and ideas that had accumulated on the trip. During this year, 1878, the phonograph made its way also to Europe, and various sums of money were paid there to secure rights to its manufacture and exploitation. In England, for example, the microscopic company paid $7,500 down and agreed to a royalty, while arrangements were effected also in France, Russia, and other countries. In every instance, as in this country, the commercial development had to wait several years, for in the meantime another great art had been brought into existence, demanding exclusive attention and exhaustive toil, and when the work was done, the reward was a new heaven and a new earth, in the art of illumination.